It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Madison's mayor says she doesn't like wheel taxes, but they're the least objectionable way to fill a major budget shortfall. We look at how state law limits local governments needing to bring in money to balance their budgets. First, since the Great Recession of 2008, no college major has lost more enrollment than English. The National Center on Education Statistics reports the number of English majors has dropped more than 25%. More students and their parents are banking on science, technology, engineering, and math to deliver more steady paychecks after graduation. But here's the thing. For people who recently got their diploma, the unemployment rate is actually lower for English majors than computer science majors. And over time, English majors can make a pretty penny. Some prominent economists are now saying we need English majors to make a major comeback. Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She recently wrote about the demand for English majors. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
Heather, this news is unexpected, perhaps shocking to some people to hear economics leaders arguing for English majors. What's going on?
It certainly caught my eye. Maybe I should fully disclose that I majored in both English and economics in college. So this is a particularly one that's very close to my heart personally. Basically there's been this huge drop off in English majors, and the transition point is really 2009, that last year of the recession when so many people were losing their homes and the stock market still looked in the dumps, unemployment, one in 10 people in the country was unemployed. So it was very scary time in the nation. And a lot of people say, were English majors really going that strong before that? The reality is from like 1990 all the way through 2008, it was like a pretty flat line. About 50,000 people a year majored in English. And that was pretty steady. But the Great Recession really changed things. And people just flocked away from the major, and not just English, but this is a similar story for history, for foreign languages, for religion, for philosophy, you name it, in the humanities. So I had been thinking about this for the last few months. It happened at my own school, thinking and was really flabbergasted to hear the data at my institution and look it up nationally and see it was happening all across the country. It's happening at flagship universities, state universities. It's happening at the Ivy League schools, you name it. And basically what's making people pause a little bit here is a bunch of prominent economists, including Nobel Prize winner Robert Shiller. He's a Yale professor who's most well known for calling the dot-com bubble and also the Case-Shiller Housing Index, which is one of the often referenced indexes that tracks house prices. He's out with a new book called Narrative Economics, and he basically says, look, economists have gone so far towards building all these models to try to predict the economy and basically doing all this fancy math. And in reality, so much of decision-making at the household level and the family level is actually made by storytelling. It's made by people telling each other, hey, Bitcoin, you should buy this. You could make a lot of money. Or, hey, you could get a mortgage with only putting 1% or 2% down. And that, economists and economic policymakers need to be spending a lot more time thinking about what are the stories that are resonating and how can they potentially influence the narrative.
We posted a question about this on our Facebook page for the Ideas Network, and Jess said, you don't have to be an English major to learn how to write or communicate effectively, and some communication classes and a couple of writing classes add those to the curriculum, and we're set. So are people able to get these sort of, maybe they go into engineering or a science field, and yet with a couple of classes, can they make up some of the enrichment you get by getting an English degree?
Yeah, that's entirely true. I mean, first of all, we talked specifically in our headline about English majors being down, so much since the recession. But the reality is, it's true of all the humanities, and you get similar skills in any humanities. I think Jessica makes a very good point that certainly anyone who believes in a liberal arts education, sure, you could major in computer science, which is what a lot of people are doing now. That's been one of the top growing majors, computer science and healthcare, and you could easily major in that. And still take some entry-level or even advanced-level humanities classes. So sure, you could glean some of these basic skills. And indeed, Robert Shiller, the economist, is a good example. At the start of his book, Narrative Economics, he's obviously this major in economics, has a PhD in economics, is a Nobel Prize winner in economics, but he actually talks in the opening of his book really, really fondly about his history classes that he took, you know, as an undergraduate, and how he really, at the University of Michigan, and how he really felt that his history classes taught him far more about the Great Depression in the 30s than anything he was learning in economics. So he's a good example of that trend.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about how some economists are calling for more English majors. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us whether you majored in English or if you decided to go against it in another field, or what you think about the value of the humanities majors. Heather, when we're talking about people choosing to go into computer science or the health fields, the issue of money comes up. I mean, can English majors make money in the long term?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And obviously, this perception is out there, again, from the Ivy League students, you know, down all throughout and the whole landscape of higher education, that it's not marketable, that you're not going to make any money. You're going to end up as, you know, whatever, pick your favorite job, barista or whatnot, if you go and you major in English or history or one of those fields. But, you know, I have to say, I was surprised a little bit to look at the data when you actually, the government keeps track of the data of what happens to people 1 year, you know, a couple years out, 5 years out, and then what happens to them 10 and 20 and 30 years down the line. And what they're seeing is right after graduation, computer science majors do make several thousand dollars more on average than your typical humanities major does. So there's a little bit of a premium for those jobs and those majors, as we say in economics. But once you get about 10 years out, the landscape really changes. And what you start to see is that humanities majors are on par. They're earning the same amount as a lot of STEM fields, including computer science. And people who have studied this, they point to a couple of things. They say, look, when you become a manager of people, you need more of those soft skills and you need more of those communication skills. And those are prized equally, if not more, than some of the more technical coding skills. The other thing people point out is that, look, technology changes very quickly. And someone who's been out for 10 or more years may not be as up to date anymore on the latest technology as that new, fresh 23-year-old coming out of university. And so there, that may be another reason that some of that computer science wage premium goes away once you're starting to hit, say, your early 30s. So I was surprised to see that the outlook for English and for humanities majors is not nearly as bleak as this perception that parents in particular have when their children are choosing that college major.
We're talking about the sharp drop in English majors and why some people say it's time for a revival. Heather Long is our guest. She's an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. And you can join this conversation. Pick up the phone and call 800-642-1234. Did you major in English? What kind of work are you doing now? Maybe the Great Recession steered you or your kids away from taking more classes in English. How do you benefit today from the English courses you took in college? 800-642-1234. You can call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues just ahead. Stay with us here on Central Time. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the value of majoring in English. Some high-profile economists are saying there's a lot to gain by taking humanities classes and by reading stories about how the economy affects people's lives. Heather Long is our guest. She's an economics correspondent for The Washington Post and has written about this. And we want to know what you think. 800-642-1234. Does the world need more English majors, or is STEM the better path to employment? Do you have any regrets that you didn't major in English, or maybe that you did? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Joel on Facebook sent us a message and said, aside from teaching, occupations for English degrees are quite limited, not so much for occupations requiring education in the STEM areas. He believes that there's a benefit in well-rounded education, but we have to be realistic. Heather, what kind of jobs are we looking at people with English degrees getting these days?
I think they're absolutely right. Again, it's that difference between your prospects 1 year out versus your prospects in your mid-career, 10 year out. You know, it is interesting that actually English majors ages 25 to 29 had a lower unemployment rate than math and computer science majors. So clearly English majors are getting jobs. We don't have full transparency about exactly what those jobs are. You know, but some cynical readers have certainly emailed me to say, oh, you know, they're all baristas. But I think what it does is that the humanities majors in some ways are forced to think a little bit more broadly about what their career options are. And, you know, some people obviously go to law school. It's a major feeder into that. You know, others go into consulting and those types of professions that are very highly paid. Certainly, as we emphasize in the media, there is a huge boom in communications broadly, whether it's public relations or wanting to get your advertising and storytelling. We're living in kind of an age of comprehensible consumption of media right now.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got an English teacher or an English major in the house, Kathy from Dodgeville. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
What is your story?
Well, I got my degree in teaching grades 6 through 12 English and speech communications in 1973 from Illinois State University. And while I was an underclassman, in college, I taught freshman composition as an undergraduate teaching assistant. But I had decided I didn't want to be a teacher, and so I moved out to the East Coast and started a 25-year degree in a 25-year career, rather, in computer science. And I worked for, I took classes at several universities and had on-the-job training and had a very successful career working for NASA, General Electric, and Mobil Oil.
Kathy, thank you so much. So, Heather, it sounds like Kathy took that English degree foundation and then actually used it in the fields of science.
Yeah, and I've definitely heard a lot of success stories like that, both people who did further training to enhance their technical skills and people who have become what you might call translators. Again, there's a huge need in a lot of these technical fields for people who can explain what's going on to the advertising side, to the general public, to people who need to use these and understand these different technologies, or people who need to understand them in a policy context. I mean, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., and there's a whole universe of people whose job it is, you know, to go to and talk to politicians and try to educate them on these different fields and what, you know, what needs funding, what looks hot, where the job's going to be. So, again, there's this sort of belief that you need these technical skills when actually there's still a lot of jobs to support and surround and enhance those technical jobs and that require some humanities and softer skills.
Now let's bring on Stephanie from Menasha. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, I agree wholeheartedly with the guest's approach to education. I wanted to also advocate, though, for a liberal arts education overall, that even if you go into a liberal arts school and major in biology or computer science, say, the benefits of having a liberal arts education will bring you those skills that maybe an English major or history major might, you know, find being more prolific in their major, those skills like writing, thinking critically, analyzing. I just want to advocate for a liberal arts approach to education, especially at the undergrad level.
Thanks, Stephanie. And Heather, a liberal arts education is Stephanie's preference as opposed to fast track or tech education, where it really is focused specifically in one sector of science or math or engineering.
Well, that's certainly, I'm a liberal arts graduate, so I am biased here. I certainly endorse that approach. What I think is interesting is when I was graduating college in 2004, so you know, in college from sort of 2000 to 2004, on my campus, the math department used to argue to the students that calculus should be as integral to the liberal arts education as Shakespeare, because you know, most students were taking economics was the most popular major, followed by English. Today, it's the complete opposite. Math and computer science have risen through the ranks. These humanities fields have gone, you know, have gone down in enrollment, and now people are having to make the case of why you should still take that Shakespeare class. Meanwhile, the calculus classes are full. So I think that, you know, I agree with the caller. It's just interesting how much the bar has shifted, the pendulum has shifted one way to the other about what classes people are having to stress you still need to take if you want to be well-rounded.
Sure. And it's not just about money. It's about mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to Central Time. We're taking your calls, your questions at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the fact that there are some economics experts who are calling for more people to major in English. Teresa from Janesville wants to weigh in. Teresa, welcome to Central Time.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I totally agree with Heather that there really should be more emphasis or at least more acceptance of the idea of majoring in English. I've always loved the English language and have always been a writer. I majored in elementary education, but then later in life, I somehow stumbled upon a job as a oral history teller. So I was called the history teller at our local historical society and started doing interviews of area folks. And there was such a thirst for these stories out there. And since I've resigned from that position, I started my own business called Janesville Area Stories. But, you know, meanwhile, between then and now, I was looking around at jobs, and there are so many, you know, like web design, web storytellers, they need people to write for websites and things like this. And so there's a huge push out there, a huge need, as you were saying, for English majors, for people to be able to come out and do this.
Thank you so much, Teresa. I appreciate the perspective there. Heather, what do you hear in that story?
Yeah, obviously, I think we're sort of fast friends here. I agree a lot with what the caller said. I will, just to throw something else, this wasn't in the article, but you know, I have to say the best advice I ever got about any of this when I was wrestling with what to major in was someone who was probably in her 50s at the time, and I was agonizing, oh, if I major in this or that, what are my job prospects? What are my life prospects? And she just looked at me and said, you know, the best thing that you can do is major in good professors, you know, the people who are really going to inspire you to learn and to remember what you're learning. And good professors also tend to be people who keep in touch with some of their star students and alums who've left the school, and they tend to be the ones who can help you connect with jobs. So much of jobs is about networking at the end of the day, even more than your technical or your literary or your writing skills.
And how have colleges responded to this decline in English majors then?
It's been really tough. They've gone through this huge crisis in a lot of humanities departments, including English departments. They've tried to spice up the curriculum, if you will, so trying to offer, you know, classes about Lord of the Rings or about Game of Thrones and these types of more perhaps sexy and seemingly exciting topics to a younger generation, or movies and film and Versa and the novels that they're based off of. But enrollments really are not coming back. It's continued to be a decline in both majors, and particularly students taking those upper level classes. So I think it's an ongoing debate about whether this is going to stabilize or whether it's going to continue to decline. And you're seeing a number of universities do away with various departments or try to combine departments that would have been unthinkable even 15 or 20 years ago, to say, like, we won't have a history department anymore. We won't have a permanent language department anymore. And now these types of things are on the cutting block.
Let's fit in one more quick call. Gary from Iron River, what's your comment here this morning, this afternoon?
Yes, good afternoon, ladies. The comment I would make is it's important not to underplay the value of earnings in the first 10 or 15 years of your career. That's the time when you need to be starting your households, paying off your school loans, being able to get started, save for retirement, and being relatively short on earnings in that time period has a significant long-term economic impact, even if the salaries are the same 15 or 20 years out.
Gary, thanks so much for that comment. Heather, what about the short term? If English majors can make the same as STEM in the long run, what about what happens before you get to that point?
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point, and that's certainly why we're seeing this trend that we're seeing of people biasing towards STEM fields. It is exactly what that caller, the point that caller just made, is both parents and students are aware that if you want the best chance for a best leg up that first year out of college, then you probably would have that more likelihood of having that in more of a STEM or a technical field. And I think that's exactly why this trend is happening.
Beyond economists, do you see anybody else talking about needing a resurgence of the humanities?
Well, maybe beyond kind of, I think what's interesting is a lot of executives, when I published this piece, I was amazed how many people who run companies or who run big investment funds emailed me. I mean, again, it's this weird conundrum where those skills that served you well from those humanities fields really come into play the higher up the career ladder you go. But as that last caller just made, that's a tough calculation. Are you the one who thinks you're going to be sitting in a CEO suite or sitting in a top management job one day? And that's a bit of a leap sometimes to try to visualize yourself there. And is it worth that trade-off long-term versus short-term gains?
Right. You have to get there first.
You do.
Heather, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She wrote a recent piece about how some economists say we need more people majoring in English. Ahead on Central Time, we look at what municipal and county governments in Wisconsin can and can't do to raise revenue. And that's all thanks to state law. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new national vetting center would give Border Patrol agencies access to classified intelligence. And that's raising concerns from some security and legal experts. We talk with a reporter covering the U.S.-Mexico border still ahead. First, some local governments in Wisconsin are looking for ways to generate revenue with limited funding increases from the state. Starting this winter, drivers in Madison will pay more to register their vehicles. The city council recently approved a $40 wheel tax to help plug a budget hole that's $11 million deep. Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway says she doesn't see a better way.
I do not want to have to do a vehicle registration fee. It's not my first choice. Not by a long shot.
And not far away, Milwaukee County wants to raise county sales tax by a full percentage point. Our guest says by law, local governments don't have many options. Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
The State Department of Transportation says that about 26 municipalities and a dozen counties have wheel taxes. Most of those are around $20. What should we make of that?
What we should make of that is that Wisconsin's system of funding local governments is broken. Most mayors think the wheel tax is a really bad alternative. But the problem is in Wisconsin, and this is unique to Wisconsin, they don't have any other alternatives. Nobody funds government the way we do in Wisconsin, and frankly, the system is just simply failing.
What do you mean by the system is failing if a wheel tax isn't a good idea? Why is it the only option then that we've got?
Well, the bulk of local government funding in Wisconsin is the property tax. In fact, that's virtually the only tax. Local governments, even though wheel taxes are starting to pop up all over the state, I think you said there were 38 of them. That, by the way, is more than doubled in less than 3 years. But that still, those other revenues still only amount to about 1%, 1.5% of total local government revenues. The problem is we simply rely too much on property taxes, and we don't give local governments the option of doing more logical things like regional transit authority taxes or a local sales tax. It may interest you to know that Wisconsin is virtually the only state in the country where they have both property and sales taxes, where a local sales tax is, for the most part, not an option.
Well, speaking of local sales taxes, in Milwaukee County, leaders want to raise the sales tax from 0.5% to 1.5%, but they do need the state legislature's approval to put that to a vote. I mean, state Democrats have introduced a bill to do that, but it faces an uphill battle with the Republican majority. Why is it set up this way?
I wish I knew. The reality is Wisconsin made this decision about 100 years ago. Literally 100 years ago, where local governments could do property taxes, but if they wanted to do anything else, they needed specific legislative permission. Well, the result of that is property taxes are still too high. There's a cap on them. Local roads have been ignored for years in terms of maintenance. Local debt is rising way too rapidly. And as I said, property taxes are still too high. We've got a system that's disconnected. We don't have our funding system is not really connected to the local economy anymore. It's connected to the local building economy, but not the local commerce or manufacturing or any other economic indicators. It's all about the property tax, and that's simply backward.
Why is that?
Because taxes should respond to what's happening in the economy. If you get a new job or you get a raise, you'll pay a little more in taxes. You'll buy a little bit more, and you'll pay a little bit more in sales taxes. And therefore, the local government will kind of follow your lead, if you will. Whereas with property taxes, you could lose your job tomorrow, and your property taxes won't go down a dime. They don't respond to the economy in any real way at all. And then there's the other problem. You know, you and I have retirement accounts, right? And we keep being told you need a balanced portfolio. You need a little here, a little there. There needs to be a system of funding local governments where it's made up of property taxes, a little bit of sales taxes, and some other things. We just don't have that here.
I do want to circle back to your idea about our reliance on property taxes, though. And I wonder if the opposite of that, though, is a regressive tax, that if cities, municipalities, counties are allowed to continue to increase sales taxes, that actually hurts people who make less money for the benefit of the county.
Well, Keeley, what I would challenge you on is this notion that property taxes aren't regressive. Wisconsin is seeing a significant aging of its population. A lot of people in this state are going to be moving on to fixed incomes, and the only thing they have is their home. And if the property taxes on the value of their home continue to increase while their incomes go the other way, that's even worse than regressive. That's going to be taxing people out of their homes.
Sure. So taxing properties is not necessarily, better for people who are lower income than, say, a sales tax. That's the argument.
Well, and the other benefit, and I'm not suggesting that you fund local government 100% on a sales tax. That's just as foolish, to be honest with you. The better system is one that is more balanced, it's a little more diversified, but also that can react to people's economic circumstances. Property taxes don't do that in the short term.
Jerry DeShane is executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking about ways that local governments find money for their budgets. Jerry, let's jump back. Last week, Madison decided to pass this $40 wheel tax. We talked about it in the beginning. That's going to be the highest in the state, kicks in February. Do you see these local fees, rising? Are we seeing more of that, at least right now, while Wisconsin municipalities have fewer options?
Absolutely. As I pointed out earlier, the number of wheel tax communities in Wisconsin has more than doubled in just 3 years. And that's a reflection of local government saying, well, it's not a great alternative, but at least it's an alternative. The wheel tax was actually created in 1967, and it just sat on the books for decades. No one used it. But we're just, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but levy limits in Wisconsin have kept local budgets below the rate of inflation for over 10 years. And you're just starting to see the cracks in that system. And one of the cracks is people adopting taxes that they don't really like, but they have nowhere else to go.
What are local governments using this revenue for? Where does it go?
Well, first and foremost, you're seeing it put into roads. They've deferred maintenance on their infrastructure for as long as they can. The other thing, and the wheel tax, I believe, in Madison will fund a rapid transit, a bus rapid transit system, where Madison is working with the surrounding communities to provide options for commuters. So it's operation of local governments. Wheel taxes can only be used for transportation. But I think what Madison is looking at is this gives them some flexibility on the other side of their budget.
Yeah, and Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway said she'd rather raise property taxes or create a city income tax, but state laws don't allow it. How much freedom do local governments actually have when it comes to generating that revenue? What does that look like?
Yeah, pretty much none. I'm being flippant, but the reality is if they don't adopt a wheel tax, the only significant revenue increase they will see is if they build all sorts of houses. Wisconsin law caps property taxes at the percentage of net new construction that occurred in a community the year before. What that means is new building. If you want the ability to raise revenues, there need to be new homes built in a community. Well, and the reality is since the Great Recession of 2008, the rate of building in Wisconsin has been well below the rate of inflation. For the last 6 years, I'm trying to recall my numbers. Yeah, for the last 6 years, local government budgets have not come anywhere near the rate of inflation. But even with that, there's a limit to how much a city of Madison wants to raise property taxes. Property taxes are too high in Wisconsin.
When looking at budgeting, we hear lawmakers, local leaders talk about a balanced budget. Isn't the other option to cut expenses if you can't or won't raise revenue?
And if you don't believe local governments have been cutting their budgets, you haven't been driving on local streets lately. The reality is local governments have been belt-tightening and belt-tightening and belt-tightening for about the last 12 to 16 years since levy limits were implemented. And there's just a limit to that. I mean, while we're belt-tightening, the cost of asphalt is not going down.
What's going to happen here in Wisconsin if we don't make changes to the ways that these cities and counties can fund the programs that they deem important to their communities?
Look at Milwaukee. Milwaukee will be eliminating 60 police officer positions in their next budget. You're going to see that throughout the state. You're also going to see more wheel taxes. You will probably start to see more and more referendums. And unfortunately, what a local government referendum means is you now have a competition between police officers and teachers. Local voters are going to have to decide which one of these do we fund. We're past the point of belt tightening, Keeley, and we're into the point of which one of these essentials are we going to do without? Now, the good news is, I don't want to sit here and be a prophet of doom. There is a lot of interest among legislators. Speaker Robin Voss has talked about sales tax as an option for infrastructure. Representative Mako up in Green Bay has talked about a sales tax option. It's time we get serious about that conversation before we have to lay off too many police officers.
Jerry, thank you for your time.
Keeley, thank you very much for your interest.
Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. We talked with him about what local governments can and can't do to raise revenue. Coming up, a new government center could give border agents access to classified intelligence as they screen people entering the U.S., and legal experts are raising some concerns. That conversation is up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina.
Coming up, Senate Republicans have asked the governor to withdraw his pick to head up the state's Agriculture and Consumer Protection Agency. We'll find out why from WPR's State Capitol reporter. First, President Trump says he wants so-called extreme vetting to be part of the U.S. immigration process. In a memo from February of last year, he called for the creation of a national vetting center overseen by the Customs and Border Patrol Agency. Now, that center is nearing completion. Part of its job is to provide border agents with classified information. The move has some legal experts concerned about transparency and the possibility of the center developing its own de facto immigration policies. Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter for ProPublica. She covers immigration and the U.S.-Mexico border. She's also author of the book Bloodlines, the true story of a drug cartel, the FBI, and the battle for a horse racing dynasty. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Help us understand what kind of information this new national vetting center could provide to Border Patrol agents.
Okay, well, what it says is it has access to the 17 intelligence agencies in the country. And the way that it works is that an immigration agency, right now they're doing what's called the ESTA program through CBP, where that's for foreign visitors who come from countries that don't need visas to enter the United States. So what they'll do is they'll submit that person's name, and then they'll vet it through the 17 different intelligence agencies to see whether there's any derogatory information about that person, which will go back to the analyst at CBP to determine whether they're going to let them into the country or not.
I mean, is this the kind of intelligence that Customs and Border Patrol agents already have at their disposal?
Not really. I mean, on an individual level, if somebody rises to, a very suspicious level, then they will send it individually to various intelligence agencies where they have contacts. But the way that this would work is that everybody who applies for, entry to the United States would be run through the intelligence agencies to see if there's any derogatory information about them. And then ultimately it could be expanded to asylum seekers at the border, anybody who's wanting to adjust their immigration status, and become a citizen, basically anybody who, interfaces with the immigration system.
We've heard a lot about extreme vetting applying to people seeking asylum, wanting to verify credentials or make sure they're the kind, I guess, of people that the United States is going to accept. But this would even apply to, say, travelers on vacation?
Yes, it would. And the issue is, I mean, obviously, people need to be checked and vetted, and we don't want to let just anybody into the U.S. But the issue here is the lack of transparency, especially if the information is classified. They could tell somebody, I'm sorry, we're not going to admit you because we found derogatory information about you. And then, if you want to appeal it and inquire, well, what did you find? They'll say, well, it's classified. We can't tell you. And so you are banned from coming to the United States. So the concern of some legal experts and security experts is that if the system is politicized, as it already is, the immigration system, then, certain people could be prevented from coming in just based on, their religion or the country that they're from, where they just will not be admitted into the U.S. based on information coming from the center.
Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter for ProPublica covering immigration and the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about a new national vetting center where border agents will have access to more classified intelligence. Melissa, introduce us to a Salvadoran man seeking asylum. You found he found false intelligence working against him. What happened here?
Sure. And this is kind of how I got interested in this. I've been an immigration reporter for a long time, and typically my job is to go and, I'll go to the border or I'll go and speak with immigration attorneys, and I'll be meeting with people and learning about their cases. And, they will be somewhere within the judicial system, and there'll be documents and there'll be information. But in this man's case, he was applying for asylum at the border with his two children, and he was barred from asylum, and his children were taken away from him because they said that he was a gang member, that they had information that said that he was a gang member. And so, you know, he said, well, can I see the information because I'm not a gang member, and I can prove that to you if I can see the evidence that you have against me. And they said, I'm sorry, we can't provide you with the evidence because it's classified. And so he actually had a team of attorneys who have filed his case in court and have sued for the information, and they still haven't gotten it from the government. The government is still saying that's classified, and it's gone on about 2 years now. But what they did discover was that the information came from a fusion center that was funded by the State Department in El Salvador. So the information came from the Salvadoran military or police, is what they think. They just don't know what the evidence is. And so what's occurring now are there are layers and layers now of databases and fusion centers, and now the vetting center where the information that is being used to determine whether you come into the country or not is totally opaque. You don't know where it came from, and you can't really appeal the decision that they make.
Let's talk about what this center is actually vetting for. I mean, is this to screen potential terrorists, to evaluate who needs asylum most or something else? What's the goal?
The goal is very ambitious. I mean, right now we have terrorist screening centers. We have one that's run by the FBI. We have a pretty robust vetting system that was put into place after 9/11, looking for terrorists and preventing terrorism attacks. What this center would do is would like to expand into counterintelligence, transnational criminal organizations. So it starts to... We'd like to start vetting for other things as well. So, for instance, with counterintelligence, you know, that is maybe they allow that person to come into the United States and then they continue to monitor them and track their movements and document what they're doing in order to continue their investigation into that person. So with more traditional counterterrorism screening, you know, they detect the person before they come into the United States to prevent them from coming in. They could now be branching out to allowing people to come in, but then to continue tracking them and monitoring them as well.
Some would say that this seems to be a way to give border agents more resources to do their job. I mean, is this an idea that other government agencies are on board with? Is this something we need for our border agents?
Well, I think the idea, and it's probably a good idea, is to streamline the vetting process, to bring more information into the vetting process, and that on its face is a good idea. The problem is in how it's executed and in the details of how it's executed. And one of the issues right now is that the vetting center is overseen by CBP and DHS, and which is the Department of Homeland Security, which has had four secretaries in the last 3 years, and is now currently awaiting the appointment of another secretary. Its general counsel resigned. So a lot of the people who should be in place to oversee an ambitious project like this are not in place. Is part of the problem. So the infrastructure is not really there, I think, to make civil liberties and privacy experts feel like it's in good hands, right? That we, you know, that our privacy and everything else is going to be protected according to the law.
Melissa, thank you for catching us up.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Melissa Del Bosque is an investigative reporter for ProPublica. She covers immigration and the U.S.-Mexico border. And we just talked about the new national vetting center that could provide border agents with classified intelligence to screen everyone entering the United States, people seeking asylum, people who are just on vacation, all across the board. You are listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network, and you can let us know what you think by emailing ideas@wpr.org, and I'm Keely Boltina in Fort Rob Ferret today. A bird loose in the Harvard Law School Library now has his own Twitter. The account is sharing the bird's feelings as people try to evict him from the law library, and he is relentless. He apparently writes, "Students stop feeding me to tire me out. Good luck. I will never stop. Never stop." All caps. Harvard authorities are asking people not to give the bird food or water. They say the restrictions won't harm him, to which the bird replied, "Who is your source? Squirrel." The bird also has apparently tweeted, "Today, animal control announced very loudly, free bread crust in the bathroom, as though I am a fool. But can someone check?" And yes, I realize we're talking about a bird tweeting, but this is modern social media, folks, and we're talking about it on public radio, and we will leave no pun left unturned. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network.